This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We talk to citizens who are most impacted by the latest scratch-your-head federal policies and bring you the most interesting guests we can find. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with Corbin Addison, international best-selling author and human rights activist, and Lauren Mims, former assistant director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. But first, Nancy, are you there?
I am here. Ellen, I am here. I am so impressed with that show that you just announced, I have to say.
Yeah.
And even though...
You had something to do with it, I think.
Well, we'll see at the end what I had to do with it. But for our first, not 100 days, but, you know, it is 10 days. This is our 10th show. And I bring the quote of the man in charge. I think the radio show gets better and better and better, and it's gotten really, really good. And a lot of people are liking it a lot.
Thanks. Wow, I never thought I would want to hear words from that person. But thank
that
you.
Person, exactly.
Thanks. That was...
I think our agenda is right on track.
Right. Despite the fact that the ships went the wrong way.
I know.
You know, it's...
I know.
Someone said, go ahead.
I saw it on the... I expected to see it on the side of a milk carton because I really didn't think they could, you know, find that thing. It was quite a story.
As someone said recently, this game of train wreck, it's a game of train wreck whack-a-mole. Did that come out right? I think it was Bob Seska.
It's probably the most exercise a man is getting when he's, you know, not being carted around on his golf course.
Yeah. But there was some really good news this week, which was...
Excellent.
Mm-hmm, Bill O'Reilly, gone, axed from Fox, faux news, fired. And I really want to give some props to Lisa Bloom. I don't know, are you aware, do you know about her?
Or I know of her, but go right ahead.
She's an attorney representing a lot of these women. And she said in a statement, this is what happens when women speak our truth. We slay dragons. And she was making reference to harassment allegations from 13 years ago. And she noted that Fox should have fired them then, of course. But,
sure.
You know, thanks. She did want to thank the women who persisted that's all I want to say about that.
It's an excellent word. That's exactly what they did. And you probably... I am actually very shocked because it has been happening for so many years, but, you know, naturally, just when you just want to feel great about it, then you hear that the guy, you know, O'Reilly gets $25 million for his troubles.
Oh, totally.
You know, it's just, you know, they can't not lose in some way, you know, and do you think he's going to wind up in the White House? This is my... My prediction.
I know,
somewhere.
That does seem to be the career path for some of these people. Ralph Nader, a few weeks ago, I wanted to say this for a while, he called this the most vicious, ignorant Republican Party in its history since 1854.
Goodness.
The militarist, corporatist, racist. So on that note, there's a couple of events going on. We can protest this. There's a March for Science, April 22nd, today, in D.C., but there's also one in Charlottesville at 1:30 at Ix Park, Art Park, so people can join in there. There's a People's Climate March, April 29th, and the Nine Pillars Hip Hop Festival has been going on all week. There's a closing event, a block party, at the Belmont Bridge tomorrow, Sunday, 3 to 8 p.m. There's going to be performance, 5 solid hours of performances, DJs, dancers, and as Cullen would say, the dopest artists and food trucks.
That sounds pretty good, Ellen. That sounds like a good weekend at your place. I do want to say that I did hear that if there's anyone listening from Hawaii, we certainly
support you.
Our estate and every citizen is just as united as American as the rest of us. I cannot believe that. You heard Jeff Sessions probably describe that judge. Yeah,
he said, "I'm really amazed that a judge sitting on an island in the Pacific can issue ships or something." Yeah, it was horrible. And so, thanks for reminding us. Hawaii is a state.
Yes,
and we love them.
Yes, I know. Considering I'm sitting on an island in the Atlantic, I'm sure the judges here are waiting for theirs. Anyway,
yeah. And a lot of people. I think I read that his ancestors came from Britain, an island. Anyhow, anyway, I wanted to say that we have an amazing show today, and our first guest is Lauren Mims.
Yeah, I think this is quite. Like I said, this is quite a 10. Yes. It's already a 10.
Yes. So Lauren Mims is the former assistant director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. She's also pursuing her doctorate in educational psychology, applied developmental science at UVA. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes.
Hey.
We are thrilled that you're here. So the White House, I mean, my first question is, what did you do in that prestigious job that it's sounding like?
Well, the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans was established in late 2012 by our illustrious president, Barack Obama, and the fabulous First Lady, Michelle Obama, to advance the nation by focusing on educational excellence for African American students as a way to improve the education and the world's standing in education. I think it was incredible. There was no typical day, but what I was hired to do is focus on how we can best support African American students. And I think one of the things that I am most proud of was that most of my days were spent around listening to students and listening to educators, but providing my platform. So opening up stage at the White House, opening up stages at the Department of Education, and allowing students to really speak their truth, and how we can then, as caring and concerned adults, as administrators, as political appointees, as officials, how we can do better.
Yeah. How long did it take? Because I know you, I think, anyway, you started as an intern at the White House. Is that right?
I did.
How long did it take you to get, because it's so impressive, how long did it take you to get from intern to assistant director of this initiative?
So I interned over the summer, June through August, and then I was asked to assume the position about, I would say maybe 4 months later. It was pretty quick, but I believe that it was just a really great fit. Here at the University of Virginia, I also focus my research on African-American excellence. So it was a great fit to be able to use my research and my training here at the University of Virginia. I'm a double who, so I graduated twice from here and use my education for good. So I think it was the reason it happened so fast was it was a really great fit. And I had really great mentors while I was there.
Is that kind of like coincidental that you wound up right where you needed to be for this educational excellence initiative?
I am a woman of faith, so I believe that it was definitely not a coincidence and that it was fate. But I have a really funny story. So I applied after I joined Twitter. So it was a Twitter chat, and I really, the initiative really believes in kind of meeting people where they are. And so there are a lot of really wonderful African Americans who are ever present on Twitter. And so we decided that we were going to have monthly Twitter chats. And so before I joined the White House initiative, I participated in a Twitter chat. And afterwards they said, we have internships. And I said, awesome, I will apply for an internship. And so it started on Twitter. And that is kind of the rest is history.
That is amazing. So you work a lot with African-American girls. And were you teaching? Were you talking? And tell us about some of the events you were involved with.
Yes. And so one of the things that I'm most proud of is I started working with Black girls on AFWM Women Lead, what we called the African American Women Lead, and the idea that often Black girls are seen as problems and not seen as the geniuses that they are. in it is a fact that nationally, black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended in kindergarten through 12th grade than their white girl counterparts. And this to me is incredibly, it's terrifying to think that there are so many students, black girls, who are being pushed out of schools and are more likely to be seen as students who are thrown out of the class instead of students who should be on the gifted track. And so what we focused on was bringing students. I brought 250 students to the Department of Education for a full day of discussing what they needed to be supported in schools, as well as have them solve some of the most contemporary issues that they were facing. So we know that there are less African-American women in science, technology, engineering, and math. And so I asked students to problem solve and discuss what would what they needed to be more interested in STEM and what we could do to support them in STEM. And some of the things they said was often when they thought of who a scientist was, it wasn't often that they saw a black woman scientist in their science courses. They felt like maybe science wasn't a place where they fit in. And so we discussed creating a curriculum that would highlight what we would now call Hidden Figures, after the wonderful Hidden Figures movie, to highlight hidden figures in science. But I think that one of the most important things that I did at that job was to allow students to come up with those ingenious solutions to best support them.
Do you happen to know if the things that you worked on and the information you found out, do you know if the Department of Education is following up on any of that, is continuing it? Do you, because I know you're not there, so I'm not much sure you can answer that question.
Yeah, so I was an appointee, so I had to leave at the end of the Obama administration. But what was really great is we also had a public servant who was a career staffer, and she stayed in the office. And since then, she has held events similar to this to bring students, local publics, D.C. public school students into the Department of Education and continue the great work. So I am excited to say that she is I have passed on the torch and she is carrying on the work. So it is happening, yes.
Well, I'm excited to hear that, actually. I was not expecting to hear that. So that's great. I'm glad I asked you now. And I know that you, rightfully so, feel like literature and books are an effective way to empower young black girls. So how do you get that literature and those books in front of them?
I think that is a great question. And actually, young Marley Diaz, who was 11, she solved this problem for us. She developed the 1,000 Black Girl Books campaign. She's from Philadelphia, and she was really sick of, these are her quotes, she's sick of reading about white boys and dogs all the time in the classroom. She wanted to read about girls who looked like her or girls that looked like her classmates. And so she started a book drive to collect 1,000 Black Girl books. And since then, it's been about a year, she has collected over 1,000 Black Girl books. She's actually writing her own book that'll come out next year. But what her campaign was she's created a database that has over 1,000 Black Girl books in it so that educators can find books for students. And she's also just raised awareness. And I think that one thing that we can do in all of our classrooms is to be really courageous and look at what we're teaching. And to look at our bookshelves. Are our bookshelves representative of the nation? Are they representative of our classrooms? Are we having books that discuss what it means to be an African-American student, what it means to be a Jewish student, what it means to be an immigrant student? Those books exist. And so I think that the excuse is often that we don't have that book. But those books do exist. And so I think it's the hard work is finding those books, getting them into the classroom, and then providing opportunities for students
to read them as part of their curriculum, because I think that often we think that diversity is a nicety, but it's really a necessity. That if we want to be competitive and that we want to serve all of our students, then we need to do the hard work of ensuring that our curriculum is courageous and that it is talking about the tough issues, but it's also representative of all of those students and that everyone feels included.
This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Lauren Mims, former director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. You can find her at DreamWDeadline on Twitter. We have a few more minutes left.
Well, then.
Go ahead.
Good. I was curious.
I mean, it sounded actually, like a break, so I just thought I would say. It sounded like I was going to a break, but I didn't want to mess you up, Nancy.
You didn't. I have questions, and I'm sure Lauren has answers. I was wondering that what you were just talking about, it reminded me of that you had written an article about what you call having an international education. And what are the benefits of that, you know, in addition to reading, you know, getting a great reading list? What did you mean by that, getting an international education?
Often we get stuck in our own kind of, we grow up in the same place, and we don't often have experiences that are going to kind of reframe some of the narratives that we have in our mind. And so often our brain naturally is creating shortcuts for us to be able to live. So for example, one thing there's really important neuroscience research that talks about the importance of international travel. For example, when our brain we are naturally going to form categories so that our brain, when we see a dog, we can say, oh, that's a dog. We see another dog, oh, that's a dog. That's important. Because every time if our brain had to spend a lot of energy thinking, oh my gosh, what is that, every time we saw it, then we would be spending so much brain power trying to figure out what each thing is. So our brain has started to form schemas and kind of associate the next time we see an animal that looks like a dog as a dog. But what we don't realize is often we form stereotypes in the similar fashion, and that we see what we see many times, we start to form different ways in thinking about, okay, so I have seen certain behaviors. We ascribe certain behaviors to certain people based on our previous experiences. And so these become stereotypes. But if we are stuck in a place where we are not questioning negative stereotypes, and that Chimamanda Adichie, in her famous TED Talk of The Danger of a Single Story, talks about this. She talks about when we only see a certain perspective on the news, let's say about those who are from Africa, then we start to form stereotypes about African Americans or about Africans that don't really address the lived reality. And so I think it's so important to travel internationally and spend time in another location, learn more about people who are different from us in a really powerful way by spending time and actually going on travel and questioning all those things that we think that we know about a particular nation based on a story that's often not told by the people who are being discussed, to really learn and challenge and move forward as a nation.
Thank you. We're going to have to go to a break, but that's a great lead into our next guest, Corbin Addison, who's a best-selling author and has traveled quite extensively internationally, and we can learn what he's learned. Thank you so much, Lauren Mims, for being here. Again, you can follow her on Twitter at DreamWDeadline. Thank you so much, Lauren.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos with myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence. We're here with Corbin Addison. Before that, though, Nancy.
Yes.
Do you have a disaster?
I wonder with what we're doing now, this day's disaster, since there usually are so many, I do wonder if we will ever actually say the same one, and I probably just jinxed it. But anyway, I'm going first. So my day's disaster is Trump congratulating Erdogan for his victory on stifling democracy and consolidating power, Trump was the only one from a democratic country to call Erdogan and congratulate him on this accomplishment. And you know, I think like Hamas called, you know, and but that's about it, you know, and then him, Trump. So what do you got?
That's pretty bad. The unicorn frappuccino.
I was wondering if that would catch your radar. Apparently it did.
Yeah. But really, actually, what you did say before was what I was going to say in all seriousness.
No.
That, about Sessions, that you brought up the Hawaii. That's okay.
The Hawaii
thing. I mean, you know, but that's fine. I mean, we can move on because I think Corbin probably has, I know he has a lot of great information and a lot to say.
Okay. Well done.
So let's do that. Corbin Addison is here with us. He's an international best-selling author, world traveler, and human rights activist. He holds degrees in law and engineering. He has written 4 books, A Walk Across the Sun, The Garden of Burning Sand, The Tears of Dark Water, and his latest novel is A Harvest of Thorns. Welcome, Corbin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. We're really honored that you could be with us today. So, your books explore, each one of them explores injustice in different parts of the world, and I must say in a very elegant way. And you're an attorney, so you have an amazing combination of skills and talents. We were talking about that earlier. Have you always been a writer, and how did your writing start?
Yeah, I've always been a collector of words. When I was a kid, and it's just completely, you know, nerdy. But I actually, you know, as soon as I had a computer, I opened a little notepad file and started collecting the words that I found in the books that I was reading. And I just always loved vocabulary, and I always loved the way that, you know, writers strung together words. And so, you know, I sort of learned how to write by reading, voraciously and then trying stuff out, you know, and trial by error and so there were points along the way where people encouraged me, and I sort of discovered this in college, that I really did love sitting down and writing something. But for a while, it was mostly essays. I didn't try stories until really law school. And, you know, if for any aspiring law students out there, don't write a novel in your first year of law school. It's kind of a guarantee you're going to get bad grades. That was my my experience. Thankfully, I met my then girlfriend, his soon-to-be wife, who told me that I needed to actually apply myself at law school. So I did and got better grades, even though writing another novel in my third year. So those never got published. One of the things I learned early on about publishing is that you can write something, and it's a mountain to climb to get somebody to actually to publish it. But that's been, you know, it's been a long journey. But obviously, I've persisted and been very fortunate to have my 4 books published.
Yeah, it is very impressive, and I too was wondering, because I get that writing as a career is incredibly difficult. I was wondering how, if you had set, like in the law that you were doing, because so much of what you write has a social leaning towards it, is that the kind of law you were also doing at the time that you were sort of writing that first book?
No, actually, you know, when I went to law school, I was thinking of doing sort of constitutional law for nonprofits like religious liberties and free speech. That quickly turned into, wow, you know, it's really hard to get a job in that, and it doesn't pay very well. So I had a lot of student debt coming out of law school. So I just went into normal practice, actually here in Charlottesville for a local firm, great guys, and I learned a lot about the world. Meanwhile, continued to be the aspiring novelist. It wasn't until about 6 years into practice that I finally, I should say my wife had the idea for my first published book, A Walk Across the Sun. And it was after we had watched a film about human trafficking, which was the subject that I took on in A Walk Across the Sun. It was a feature film, and we watched it. We're horrified by it, and really didn't understand the connection between modern day slavery and the United States. And that was something that, you know, where it led my wife to say, "Hey, look, you know, you've got this passion for writing. You've written books that people don't want to publish, but they're very different. So why don't you combine your passion for justice that took you to law school and your love for storytelling and write something about this subject that might open people's eyes in the same way this film did for us. So that was kind of the beginning of writing about social justice issues. Mm. And what I learned pretty quickly is that it's a cool framework for stories. If the world is the stage, there are endless stories about injustice that can be told, that need to be told, especially about injustice to the poor, which very often these are issues that get overlooked, you know, by the media and by all of us, you know, living in the West, you know, with our sort of our frame of reference.
And because you do like to travel, is that specific? And for your books, I mean, do you ever just travel to travel, or is it always with the intent of I'm looking for a book idea?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be able to travel quite a bit before I started writing these stories, and I think that was, you know, part of the reason that I fell in love with this kind of story, because I realized quite quickly, I mean, as a lawyer doing research for clients, I knew how to do research, deep research for complex litigation. And as a traveler, I mean, I was comfortable in the world, though, you know, my books have taken me to places I never, ever would have dreamed of going before. But they've, you know, I love what Lauren said about, you know, the value of travel to education, because the truth is, in my mind, travel is probably the world's best education, travel and reading. I mean, if you combine the two of those things, you can pretty much learn anything that's worth knowing in the world. And travel, you know, has brought me into contact with amazing people through the years. I've gotten a chance to meet heroes and then weave their stories into my fictional stories. You know, and so what I would say now is that most of my travel is related to my writing. Occasionally it's travel just for tours and stuff. And to be honest, I would like to do a whole lot more travel with my family. But my kids are just getting to the age where they're easily portable. So my wife is looking forward to me actually taking her, on some of these adventures.
Well, I'm glad you're declaring all this on the air now.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Have to do it.
She's going to hold it over
exactly.
My head.
Exactly. We have the audio. It's going to be on a podcast. You know, it's there.
There you go.
Is your writing process always the same, or is it never the same?
Every book is different, so in that sense, I kind of feel like I'm reinventing the wheel, but not completely, because I at least have a framework. So I'll start with, you know, an issue, you know, that either my wife, actually Marcy has given me the idea for three of my four books. My literary agent gave me the idea for the other one. And I've actually just finished a fifth, which right now my agents are taking out to publishers, which was also my wife's sort of partly her idea. And then I'll take, you know, the issue and I'll start thinking about, how do I want to tell the story? What are the places that I need to go? Who are the people I need to meet and interview? Who are the characters that need to sort of form the center of the story, you know, carry the narrative forward? And then I dive deep, you know, like I used to do as a lawyer, and just start reading a ton. You know, and my network allows me to kind of send emails and pick up the phone and call people and get in, you know, interviews with folks who know a heck of a lot more than I do, the experts. And they give me ideas, you know, for further reading and other people I need to talk to. And then they help me with my on-the-ground research. So, you know, and then I always design my trips after I know pretty much what I'm going to be writing about and who the main characters are. Because the trips need to be really condensed and focused. And then when I go, you know, when I land on the ground, I always know it's going to be a kind of iterative process where I come with ideas, but the people I meet and the things I see, the experiences I have are going to, you know, feed back into the loop, and either reinforce or change my ideas. So I just kind of go with open hands and see where the road leads. And it's always been, you know, I had so many wonderful moments where I've been sitting down with somebody And they, you know, we're interviewing, we're having an interview, a conversation, and they give me an idea that absolutely fits, you know, the story, or might blow up something in the story, but in the end becomes a total gift. So that's kind of my process. And then I come home and sit down and actually write. I don't write on the road. I come back. I've done all my research. I don't have a full outline, but I've got sort of in my head where I'm going. And then I sit down and the words kind of flow.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Corbin Addison, bestselling author and human rights activist. So, Corbin, I really want to get into Harvest of Thorns at some point, but could you give us just a brief idea for readers who don't, or listeners who don't know your work, what the other three books are about?
Yeah, sure. So Walk Across the Sun took me to India and Europe, and then sort of the underside of our own society here, into the strange and lurid and troubling world of modern-day slavery, particularly on the sex trafficking side. And for those of you who think that sounds daunting and dark, and I can't, you know, dig into that, I wrote with you in mind. You know, it's a fast-paced, fun to read, for the most part, sort of thrill ride, and yet it is educational, and informative, and I think, you know, you'll end up, loving it. So, there's that. There's The Garden of Burning Sand, which took me to Southern Africa, and sort of, you know, is focuses on gender-based violence, particularly in the African context, on young girls and the connection with HIV, and then wraps it back into the Western context with foreign aid, and the challenges, you know, of the U.S.'s sort of, relationship and debts to Africa, because of the past. And then The Tears of Dark Water took me on the craziest journey, into the heart of Somalia. And, I actually traveled there. That was part of my research. And had some wild experiences, you know, being, under guard and whatnot. You know, if we had hours, I could tell you the stories. But then I, you know, wrote a story, The Tears of Dark Water, that really kind of delves into the heart of the Civil War. And many of its consequences for the people of Somalia and the world. So whether it's piracy or terrorism, you know, I wanted to feature kind of the tension between the vast majority of Muslims in the world and then those few who are radicals. And so that's kind of, you know, that's Tears. And then A Harvest of Thorns, my most recent one, is about the underside of the global economy, particularly as it relates to the fashion industry, which is obviously profoundly relevant to all of us. We're all of us are sitting here wearing clothing, and we do 99% of our lives. So, you know, it was fun to write something that's so obviously relevant to all of my readers.
Well, I'm totally curious about the other three books, and I hope we can go back. But since you landed on Harvest of Thrones,
Thorns.
I did.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Harvest of Thorns.
Harvest of Thrones. Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry.
That's
totally what I wrote down. I just want to know, what was the news story that got you started on that?
You know, it was actually my wife who suggested, you know, I'd written about sex trafficking, which is one side of the modern-day slavery coin. The other side is forced labor and labor trafficking. And she said, why don't you write a story about that? So I thought about it, but it's an incredibly broad subject. I mean, it touches so many different industries. All you got to do is go on the Department of Labor's website and look up the tainted goods list, and you realize that half the stuff we buy is touched by child or forced labor from certain countries in the world. So I did that, and I was realizing there's no way I can, you know, put all of this in a story. So I've got to pick an industry. And I had the thought, you know, as I was reading, I saw garments over and over and over again in various countries. And I thought, you know, that's, you know, of all the things I could pick, that's so super relevant. So, you know, I thought, okay, you know, I'll focus on clothing. But then, you know, it's in so many different countries. I mean, obviously the garment trade, the, you know, whatever you call it, labor, fashion, whatever, it touches so many countries all around the world. So how do I focus? Well, as I was doing some initial research, I came across really fascinating and deeply disturbing documentary, a short documentary that was done by an NGO about the comparison between the Tazreen Fashions factory fire in Bangladesh back in November of 2012 and the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire in 1911 in New York City. And the comparison showed that history had almost literally to the detail repeated itself, and you know, but of course half a world away. And it showed, you know, in a way that's deeply distressing, that somehow garment sourcing and clothing manufacturing hasn't actually changed that much in 100 years. What's happened is, you know, the laws got better here, labor laws. And so, you know, when the world opened up with globalization, the companies went overseas and started manufacturing in places where they could get around the labor laws. And so in the end, history repeats itself, and we have women, now Bangladeshi women, jumping out of the upper story windows to escape flames. And I thought, that's the place I need to begin the story, because it's on the other side of the world, but it's an American company that's at the center of the narrative. And so that connection, you know, it just brought it home right away. It's like, this is actually relevant to all of us, despite the fact that it's happening around the world.
We're going to go to a break. We're talking with Corbin Addison, bestselling author, and we have been speaking with Lauren Mims, who has worked with the Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Corbin Addison. He's an international bestselling author and human rights activist and world traveler. We're talking about his latest book, A Harvest of Thorns.
Indeed, A Harvest of Thorns. Corbin, I wanted to ask about, you know, the research that you had to do for this book, and you mentioned the awful factory conditions and child labor and forced labor. I was wondering, how difficult was it for you to get people to speak to you freely?
Yeah, it would have been really hard had I not you know, been able to connect with the fixers that I had in the various countries that I went to. So I've learned through the years to kind of do investigative journalism on some level. I mean, my product is different, but the research is very similar. And I've got a lot of really cool friends, you know, who are just amazing and have, you know, Rolodexes. Can we still say that? Have Rolodexes that, you know, dwarf my own, and who have helped me when I start a new book. So with this one, I knew I was going to need to meet some workers, but I really wanted to meet people all throughout the garment supply chain, including representatives of the brands. And I knew that was going to require, you know, a lot of travel as well as, you know, research here in the U.S. So I put out feelers, and some of my friends stepped up and basically said, look, you know, if you can get to this place, I've got some people who can help you there. And so as it turned out, you know, I've interfaced through the years with NGOs on the ground. So that was part of this research. In Malaysia, there's a great group called Tenaganita, which has been working to combat forced labor, both in various industries like electronics and garments, to combat sex trafficking in Malaysia. And they were extremely helpful to me. One of their young investigators he took me under his wing and said, you know, I can get you in to a dormitory and, you know, at night, and you can have a conversation with some migrant workers who are actually making for, you know, Adidas and Ralph Lauren Polo and various other brands. And so he was, you know, he did that. And it was pretty incredible, because I sat down with these guys who are all Bangladeshis, all migrant workers, and every single one of them told a story of de facto forced labor. I mean, under the International Labor Organization definition. And so, you know, it wasn't actually hard to find, scratch the surface in Malaysia with migrant workers, and you find conditions of forced labor. The brands, you know, Adidas is a great brand. I know somebody there, and when I spoke to him about it, he was like, yeah, this is why we're actually starting an initiative to combat forced labor in our supply chain. You know, the companies know that these sorts of things are happening, but they often don't know, you know, exactly what's going on the ground, which is something I realized quite quickly. It's amazing how much the brands don't know. They know more than they let on, but they don't know nearly enough. So I found that in various other places. I went to Bangladesh. I met some of the women who jumped out of the Tazarine Fashions factory and survived. Those were some really hard interviews, listening to their stories. And I went to Jordan as well, you know, and met with people from the ILO. That's a country that surprisingly sources quite a lot of clothing to the U.S. because we have a sort of most favored nation trade agreement with them. So it was quite a lot of research. It was a round the world trip.
Can you tell us some of those stories or a story or two that stuck out for you that were pulled at your heartstrings?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I talk about when I talk about my stories is that I feel like I'm kind of a curator, you know, of other people's pain. It's something that I don't always know what to do with because, you know, I can turn it into a story that I hope is compelling, that I hope opens people's eyes. But the people that I meet with, the real people, you know, who dignify me with telling me their stories, you know, I have to leave and I come back to my, you know, reasonably privileged world in Virginia and in the U.S. and leave them in their circumstances. And it's very hard to know how to hold that. The hardest, I think, has been, you know, coming back from Bangladesh after meeting with these women who survived the Tazreen Fashions fire. You know, I met with them in their little one-room cinder block dwellings within sight of the burned-out factory, and they were still there. It was a couple of years after the fire. They were, you know, one woman was about to be turned out by her landlord because she was permanently disabled and could no longer work or afford the, you know, minimal rent for this place. You know, there were other, all of them were young, and most of the were of garment workers around the world are women. One girl in particular kind of inspired one of the characters in the beginning of my story, you know, told me what it was like. I mean, I'm sitting there with them, and all of them are permanently disabled, and they're on the bed. You know, it's basically a room barely bigger than the bed, and they gave me, you know, a seat, a plastic, you know, chair in front of the bed, and I'm interviewing them as they're sitting on the bed. And one woman, you know, told me the story. She's 26 years old, two kids, a husband who also worked in the factory, you know, of being on one of the upper floors. And, you know, when the fire broke out and realizing, and if you, you know, read this, my book, I mean, the opening prologue is really as close to reality as I could make it. To the point where I actually had a Bangladeshi worker afterward read the story and tell me that I had nailed it, which was, you know, a great review, delightful. But the woman whose story really inspired that scene, you know, told me about having to break down the barriers. You know, it was totally dark in the neighborhood. The lights had gone out because there were roving blackouts. So the neighborhood was dark and the factory had generators providing power, but those generators went out as soon as the fire started, so they were totally in the dark, couldn't see anything in the outside, but they could hear the roar of the flames, and the only way out, because there was a single stairwell, there were no fire escapes, and the stairwell was blocked by flames, the only way out were the windows, but they had to break down barriers because the owner was afraid that they would steal clothing by throwing it out to Confederates on the ground, so the owner had actually put up three different layers of barricades. He put up windows, that is glass. He put up netting, sort of cloth netting, and then he'd also put up bars. So this woman and the people around her had to break through those just to get air in, and then to have to make the decision between do we stay and burn or do we jump and, you know, entrust ourselves to gravity and maybe die. And this woman told me what it was like to stand on the ledge and make the decision to jump. And I'll never forget that. I will never forget the look in her eyes, the words she spoke. It was in Bengali, so it was translated. But she told me that she remembered a quote from the Quran. Most Bangladeshis are Muslim. And the quote from the Quran I put right in my story. I mean, it's just profound. I mean, it's, you know, she thought every soul shall taste death. And she realized that if she stayed and burned, her family would not have a body to bury. But if she jumped and died, at least her family would be able to bury her, which, of course, as a Muslim, is very important. So that's what caused her to jump. As it turned out, she was knocked in the air by someone who also had jumped and fell through a corrugated roof of a nearby building, which slightly cushioned her fall. She landed on the ground, was knocked out and unconscious for the better part of a day. This happened at night, so it was all overnight into the morning. Dragged out, thought for dead by the people who were, sort of trying to rescue, and left on the side of the road. And her brother found her and took her to a hospital, where she spent 2 weeks in recovery, and then was turned away because her family couldn't afford to pay the hospital bills. And so she's still permanently disabled, needs medical care. And I was listening to the story and thinking, how is it possible that they were there that night making clothes for Walmart in a last minute order, and these women have not been paid compensation to care for them? Like, how is it possible that we could do this as a society and leave these women in such an abject state? I will say, since then, there's been an initiative that has provided some compensation to these victims. I'm not sure if it's enough, but it's at least better than it was when I did the interview. But that's a story that I carry in my heart and don't always know what to do with.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that we're talking with Corbin Addison. That is a story about A Harvest of Thorns is his book, where he talks very, elegantly about the situation there. And a little bit speechless, but, what do you do with that? I'm not sure you have the answer, but perhaps writing is an outlet for you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, there's a catharsis that comes from putting words on the page and telling a story that I hope is compelling to my readers. And, you know, I could have told a story, and I think my publishers were kind of expecting me to tell a story that would be victim-centered. It would tell a story, you know, of a woman like this that would carry the story through that narrative. But I really wanted to tell a story that goes right to the heart of the problem, which is that of all the different stakeholders, you know, brands, governments, consumers, workers, NGOs, the one group that has by far the most power to affect change are the clothing brands themselves. They have the most money, and they by far have the biggest clout in the supply chain. And so I really wanted to tell a story about an American company, not necessarily a bad company, even better than many of its competitors, but one sourcing clothing from around the world, an omnichannel retailer, $65 billion company headquartered in Virginia, and that gets exposed by this fire at the beginning in a shocking way that creates a huge PR nightmare for them and actually inspires their African American chief lawyer, their general counsel, to undertake an investigation into the supply chain to try to figure out how this happened. And what he finds in doing this investigation is far more horrifying and troubling than he ever could have imagined, and leads him on a journey that he never expected to go on, a deeply soul-searching journey for him, both as an executive and a lawyer and as a human being, and that leads him to make some choices to try in a dramatic fashion to affect change both within his company and in the broader industry in the world.
Wow. So what can we do? You said we all, 99% of the time, we're wearing these articles of clothing. What can we do and what should we look for to help the situation?
Yeah, one of the great challenges we're faced as consumers is just the lack of transparency. We can look at labels on our clothes and they tell us nothing more than the country that it came from. And very often Americans will think, oh, well, I hear something bad about Bangladesh, so that tells me I should not buy anything made in Bangladesh. But I can tell you that there are factories in Bangladesh that are have better conditions than factories here in the U.S., in fact, dramatically so. So it isn't – the labels tell us nothing. And the lack of transparency is a real challenge. But there are a number of things that we can do. I mean, one of the things that's kind of exciting about the timing of this interview is that Fashion Revolution Week is next week. It actually starts tomorrow. And this is an organization, Fashion Revolution, out of the UK, but it's kind of everywhere. And they're doing, a big push to get, consumers, ordinary folks like you and me, as well as, high-level folks, high-profile celebrities and whatnot, to post all over social media and call the brands and ask who's making my clothes. So if you go on their website, if you go on their social media feeds, you'll see all kinds of ways in which they're putting a face on the clothing that is being made that we're buying around the world. It's really interesting. And the timing, of course, is actually tied to the now four-year anniversary of the Rana Plaza factory collapse in Bangladesh that claimed the lives of over 1,100 victims, workers, back in 2013. So that's actually this coming week. So, you know, if you're a clicktivist, if you're an activist, you want to get online and do something, join Fashion Revolution. And they've got a lot of interesting ways to join in easily, you know, from your home, from your phone. But I think in a broader sense, you know, one of the things that I realized in doing this is it really, it's an industry and cultural problem. What we've done is we've turned fashion into a disposable article. Instead of it being sort of art for the body, you know, something beautiful that we invest in as an expression or a statement about ourselves, it's something that we consume in vast quantities and then throw away. And the industry has fueled this with its advertising and with its, you know, constant quest for higher profits. But, you know, we have bought into it. We've bought into fast fashion, and we filled our wardrobes to the bursting and to the breaking point, right, with cheap clothes. And we've become addicted to cheap as a consumer society. And that's actually fueling a lot of this. So we've got to actually, you know, a couple of friends of mine have this idea, and I love it, to do with fashion what we've done with food. I mean, back in the 90s when I was a teenager, the coolest place to eat was McDonald's, you know, have a Big Mac. You know, now McDonald's is selling kale salad and trying to compete with the slow food movement. I mean, we've got to slow fashion down and recover something of the beauty of what it means to make quality clothing and buy less and enjoy what you have.
Thank you. We're running out of time. Really fascinating to have you, Corbin. His latest book is A Harvest of Thorns. And Nancy, take it just for 30 seconds. Give me 30 seconds while I do some dialing here.
I will totally give you 30 seconds. In fact, that will give me the chance to mention that if you have any comments about our 10th show or our 9th or our 11th, we have a Twitter page, and we have a Twitter handle, conveniently, which is capital AOS Radio, lowercase. And Great. We would love to hear from you always about anything. And as far as these books, I hope everyone Googles Corbin Addison's name and checks them out. They're so dense. And anyway,
and I can say
you're back, Ellen.
I'm back. I'm sorry about that. You can follow him at Corbin Addison, and his website is an amazing website, actually. I advise you to go there now, corbinaddison.com. And you can also follow Lauren Mims at DreamW Deadline. So, and you know, I'm not the greatest reader in that I don't read a lot, and I always want to read more and find more time, but I've read a couple of Corbin's books, and they're amazing. I should have said that earlier. And I have another friend, the same thing. I'm not a reader, she said, and she just flew through the book, couple books she has. So I'd read them. They're pretty fantastic. So I wanted to mention that next week, because we have 1 minute, Nance.
So my palate cleanser is this, though. It's Happy Earth Day, everybody. It's number 47.
Fantastic. So next week, we will have the honor of having Larisha Hawkins, the professor who was fired by Wheaton College when she showed solidarity with Muslims, and after suggesting that believers in Christianity and Islam followed the same God. So we're lucky to have Larisha Hawkins next week. And remember, apropos of our show today, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. See you, Nance.
Yep.